Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Adam Harris, the assistant social editor at ProPublica. Across the country, thousands of police departments fail to report hate crimes for the FBI's hate crime statistics. Today, we're speaking with Associated Press reporter Christina Cassidy about how she, along with a team of reporters, uncovered disparities in hate crime statistics, and how, for victims, the failure in reporting of these crimes at all levels alienates them. Welcome to the show, Christina.
Hi, Adam. I'm glad to be here.
Before any of the reporting began, what made you want to look at hate crimes and hate crime statistics specifically?
Well, Adam, it actually began about a year ago with the shooting at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. I had recently joined a new team that the AP had formed dedicated to looking at state issues from a national perspective. And the shooting happened, and almost immediately there was an indication that hate may have been a motivating factor. And so we looked for a way to help. And one of the ways that we thought we'd take a look at hate crime statistics. And as we started looking at the data, something really jumped out at us, and that was the fluctuation, the number of South Carolina agencies that had been reporting the information to the FBI. The number of agencies varied from year to year. And if I recall correctly, there was one year where there was quite a significant drop-off of agencies. And so that piqued our interest. And as you know, with data, any fluctuations with reporting magnified on a larger scale really impacts the overall numbers. And so working with my editor, Tom Burden, we decided to map out a vision for a project that would look closer at the reporting.
Your investigation starts in South Carolina. What's your first step in terms of getting the data?
Well, when we first started just looking at South Carolina, we went to the FBI's website and started looking at the numbers because they issue a report every year on the number of hate crimes that happen in the U.S., I pulled the data on South Carolina, and so we got that sort of preliminary indication that I mentioned, that there was some fluctuation in the number of reporting agencies from year to year. So we decided to start with a few states to be able to gather the data, first pull in the names of all of the local law enforcement agencies in those states, and we went to the agencies that are charged with training and standards and practices to get that sort of authoritative list of the local law enforcement agencies. And so we started in a couple of states to see what was happening, and then we decided to expand the project.
And when you noticed that the data fluctuated in terms of how they were reporting, FBI Director James Comey's called for better reporting of hate crimes and tracking of hate crimes nationally. What did you find interesting about how those numbers were fluctuating?
Looking at it in total was where the interest was most acute. Because once we had all of the data for all 50 states, and we had the list of all of the law enforcement agencies, and we were able to run the analysis to be able to isolate the number of agencies and to come up with the fact that it was more than 2,700 local law enforcement agencies across the country, representing about 17% of all of those agencies. I think that to us was the moment where, you know, we felt like we had a good story.
So you said you found more than 2,700 departments who haven't submitted a report to the hate crime tally in the past 6 years. But in those departments, did they have their own recording of these hate crimes?
In some cases, actually in many cases, yes. But it wasn't getting filtered up to the national count. And that's where you bring in the concerns from the community groups and the activists who say that, you know, this national count is really how we sort of measure ourselves and sort of our progress when it comes to dealing with hate. And so even though they may be kept on a local level, they're not being counted as part of that national tally. And the information is not easy to access for people living in those communities. In many cases, they'd have to call up their police department and ask them.
And why are so many of those local departments underreporting hate crimes? Is it just that it's not a priority for them?
Well, I can tell you that no law enforcement agency that I spoke to said that they were not reporting this intentionally, that this was an intentional act. Most agencies said that they thought they were reporting misinformation, even though they were not. And some thought they didn't have to file reports because they hadn't investigated any of these crimes. So I think that from the law enforcement perspective, it seems to be more awareness about this. And, you know, the fact that the FBI wants this information and is encouraging them to submit this information, and perhaps through the reporting of this story, we'll see some increases in reporting. Just through the course of my working on this project, you know, the law enforcement agencies I spoke to said, you know, thank you for letting us know about this. We're going to look into this, or, you know, we're going to start, you know, changing our procedures so that we can make sure that this is reported.
Well, after kind of the national information is gathered, where do you start looking for kind of those unique stories to kind of paint the broader picture?
That was one of the biggest challenges associated with this story. We knew early on that we needed to have the personal stories to illustrate why this matters. And so we spent a lot of time researching cases and trying to identify some individuals that would be willing to talk with us about what happened to them. I mean, these are intensely personal attacks and certainly traumatic to experience. And so having the opportunity and the willingness of the people that were quoted in my article to really open up and talk about what happened was really special. So we were able to identify some pretty powerful examples and, in their words, tell the readers why this matters, that it's important to know not just that the person who attacked them, you know, went to prison and faced some sort of justice, but also to know that what happened to them counted, that it mattered, and that people were paying attention to it, and that we as a society are doing everything that we can to make sure that there aren't future victims. As one person said, you know, to bring a better future. That's why this is important.
How were you able to identify people who weren't counted in the tally?
Well, that was definitely one of the more challenging aspects to this project. Certainly, there was a ton of data. I mean, we had, you know, over 16,000 local law enforcement agencies, and we had data for a six-year period. So the data itself was a big endeavor. But then also to try to identify people who we could tell this story and to tell their stories, again, to sort of underscore why this matters. That was really challenging. We had to do a lot of news searches. We had a researcher in New York help with the project to go through and identify cases, hate crimes, suspected hate crimes. And then we had to go through and basically cross-reference those law enforcement agencies with the FBI records and what we had found and uncovered in terms of, you know, the 2,700 local law enforcement agencies that had not reported. And so that led us to a case in Oregon that we mentioned in the story. That also led us to Brandon White in Atlanta. And it also led us to Bogalusa, Louisiana, where there was a woman who believed that she was the victim of a hate crime, and yet it was never solved, and it was never called a hate crime. And so we were able to use those news stories and then marry that against our data to be able to identify those cases. And then, of course, you know, reaching out and having those conversations and asking them to open up for us and to share their stories.
And was it difficult getting them to open up?
I think that it was difficult initially, reaching out and explaining what we were working on and asking them to open up and to share what for many of them was the worst moment of their life. And I think that they recognized early on the importance of what we were working on. While it may have been hard to talk through what they had been through, I think that they were very compelled to speak out because they feel that it's very important that other people are not victims. And they felt that this was a way to put that forward. I will say that one person we approached did not want to talk.
And oftentimes, you know, victims, you know, won't report. As much as law enforcement isn't reporting these crimes to the federal tally, victims aren't reporting the hate crimes themselves. I found it shocking that 40% of hate crimes go unreported by victims. Can you tell us a little bit about the community fears that you encountered during your reporting?
Yes, there was one person that I spoke with, Brandon White. He was basically jumped outside of a convenience store here in Atlanta by a group of young men yelling gay slurs. And after the beating, he went home. He didn't call police. He went to sleep. And it was the next day after a video of the attack had surfaced online and people had seen it and recognized him that he was sort of confronted with this. And he spoke about his fears, that he'd grown up in sort of a rough neighborhood and there wasn't a lot of trust with police. And there was a sense that, you know, if something happens, you know, you take care of it yourself. So when you look at those statistics that you cited, those were estimates by the Bureau of Justice Statistics that 40% are estimated not to report to police. You know, they cite various reasons, including fear of reprisal and sort of the feeling that, you know, police won't do anything about it.
And during your investigation, when you're combing through this information from, you know, Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and these states with deep histories of racial trouble and racial strife, what did you find interesting about the Deep South and how the Deep South was reporting these hate crimes as compared to some of the rest of the country?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because it wasn't across the board in the Deep South. So Georgia, for instance, and Alabama, they had only about 10 to 12% of their local law enforcement agencies not reporting this information. But just a few states over, in Louisiana and Mississippi, those are some of the highest totals of non-reporting agencies in the country. Louisiana at almost 59% and Mississippi just under 65% of all local law enforcement agencies that were not reporting this information. So it definitely was indicative of what we found on a larger scale, which is just there's really so much of a lack of uniformity when it comes to this reporting, that you have these myriad of responses. I mean, California and Florida, for instance, huge population centers, and their reporting is, you know, very high. And then you also, not too far from us, in Atlanta, Tennessee, virtually all local law enforcement agencies in Tennessee are reporting this information.
You mentioned Mississippi, and that's where, you know, as you reported in 2011, James Anderson was killed, and the police department in Jackson didn't file any hate crime reports from 2009 to 2012. So this was a national incident that wasn't in the national hate crime statistics. Were there other kind of ones that were in the national spotlight that you found that were unreported?
Well, the Brandon White case in Atlanta, that was another case that was fairly high profile. And so the Atlanta Police Department in 2012, they had submitted report that said they didn't have any hate crimes for the first 9 months of the year, and then there was no report filed for the last 3 months of that year. Well, Brandon White was attacked in February, and his attackers were adjudicated in court, I think it was by May of that year. It was a very fast resolution in that case. You know, that's another example of where you have an instance where you have a high-profile case, and yet the numbers, you know, don't make their way up the system. And when we're looking at the numbers as a whole, if we don't have a really good sense of what's happening, as a few people were quoted in my story as saying, then we can't tackle this problem. If we don't have a good understanding of how many hate crimes are happening every year, how are we going to address this? And those are some of the questions that we explored in my story.
And, of course, not all of police departments are bad at reporting these hate crimes. So when did you start finding the states such as Nevada where, you know, all of the departments report hate crimes, or Florida? What are some of those states doing different than the other states to kind of prioritize this hate crime reporting?
Well, I think it varies. I mean, I think California, for instance, has a very rigorous reporting system run through the state, and the Attorney General there, you know, issues reports every year, very high profile, and they talk about the statistics and the importance of reporting. In Tennessee, for instance, they also have a very robust reporting system, and so the state officials are in regular contact with the local law enforcement agencies, and, you know, if they see a missing report, they're checking in and saying, hey, this report's missing, we need to get this report. And, you know, they even have a law in Tennessee that allows for the state to withhold funding for non-reporting. And so they've used that in some cases where funds have been withheld. There are ways to improve the reporting, but those are decisions that are made on the state level. As we noted in the story, the overall reporting system that the FBI runs, the Uniform Crime Reporting System, is voluntary. The Hate Crime Statistics Program is voluntary.
And so you've talked about it a little bit, but what's the benefit of having comprehensive annual accounting of hate crimes? You know, according to advocates and those who say that we're not doing enough, why is it important to have those numbers?
I think with speaking to the victims themselves, they expressed a lot of pain and disappointment that what happened to them wasn't part of the national count. And it may sound like, okay, we're just talking about statistics. Your attackers met justice. They were, you know, prosecuted. And, you know, were sentenced to prison in some cases. But the fact that they were not counted was painful. And they were disappointed in law enforcement agencies for not doing something they thought was fairly simple, filing a report with the FBI. And I think Mark Potok with the Southern Poverty Law Center put it very well in my article. He said, quote, if these crimes are never really counted, it's a way of saying they are not important, end quote. And I think that that resonated for a lot of the people that I spoke with, because really having a good understanding of how many hate crimes happen in the U.S., if we had a good number, what might that mean? If the number, instead of the 5,000 to 7,000 that are reported, you know, roughly every year by the FBI, what if it was closer to 100,000 or 50,000? What would that mean for a national discussion on hate and hate crimes? And would it mean more resources for law enforcement? Would it mean more training, more community outreach? And so those are all of the questions that are raised that we don't have the answers to, because we don't have a definitive count.
And if there's one thing that you'd hope people learn from this investigation or take away from this investigation, what would it be?
Well, I think the responses that we've been receiving just from the law enforcement agencies themselves, both in my reporting and then, you know, this story, the data was sent out to our members across the country, TV, newspaper, radio stations, and they were calling and writing their own stories about their local agencies that were on the list and asking them, you know, why they weren't reporting. And so I think for me, the important outcome potentially is that we will see improved reporting. And with improved reporting, then we'll have a better sense of how many hate crimes are happening in this country. And potentially, you know, if it's a much higher number, then, you know, there might be a national discussion about what needs to be done.
Well, thank you for your time and for speaking with us about your investigation, Christina.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the ProPublica podcast. We'll be back next week.